This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Eric LeMay, a host on New Books in Literature, a channel on the New Books Network. Today, I interview Amy Wright. Wright is an essayist and artist, one who works across a dizzying and dazzling range of subjects and media. However, in her new book, Paper Concert, A Conversation in the Round, not only does Wright's voice shine, but she also celebrates the voices of nearly 50 other contributors. She's written, or maybe I should say assembled or orchestrated, the thoughts and reflections of a dizzying and dazzling range of thinkers, artists, scientists, and true human beings, sharing their experiences and reflections on what it means to be, to live, to make, to grieve, to laugh, and, as Wright's entire book attests, to share meaningful conversations that leave us all the richer for the encounter. I'm deeply grateful to share our conversation with you today. Amy Wright, welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, Eric. Thank you.
It's great to have you, and I'm so excited to talk about your book today, Paper Concert, A Conversation in the Round. And I think one of the exciting things will be to talk about even what that title promises for readers. But I wanted to start you off with a really easy question. And I should probably say this is a book that is shaped by questions that you are asking authors. And there's one that comes back again and again. So just off the bat, when in your life have you felt the freest?
Oh, that seems like an easy question, but it's actually pretty complicated, which is why I kept asking different contributors over the years when they had felt the freest, because it changes, like so many of our answers do. But I felt freest as a kid, really growing up on a farm, because the farm, as I'm going to describe in one of the excerpts from the book that I hope to read for you, it was a wide open space. And so we just had a lot of, my brother and I had a lot of freedom to run and play and explore the woods. And I don't think you ever get quite as free feeling as being a kid before you recognize any of the world responsibilities. You just get to be without any of those in the woods and besides streams, running around, playing.
And so one of the terms that shapes the title is concert. Could you tell me a little bit about why it is that this question comes back to you? You ask it again and again of different authors, and it's sort of this, I don't know, chorus or refrain that helps give shape to the entire book. What was it that made you so curious about this question of freedom and even freest, you know?
I ask a lot of really hard questions in the book. I ask what it's like to grow up native in America. I ask what it's like to grow up a Black and female in Tennessee. I ask what it's like to experience gender discrimination and sexual orientation discrimination and various really personal and weighty questions. And so to some extent, I wanted to counterbalance that with some moments of beauty and grace and levity. And so I also talk about humor. And so there are a lot of moments about, you know, what's your favorite joke? I ask a lot of people that too. And that provides kind of the similar, a similar function. It's not appropriate. Of course, when in your life have you felt freest isn't appropriate across the board for all the contributors interviews either. So it just kind of depends on the nature of the conversation, but it's definitely a preoccupation that I've carried over the years.
Well, let me ask a little bit further. It could have been, given what you're saying, it could have been when you felt the happiest, when you felt the most joyous, when you felt the most levity. But, you know, we're thinking a lot right now in America and globally about freedom with the the debates about freedom around the pandemic, with the issues of freedom that are coming up, with the racial reckonings around the Black Lives Matters movement, with what's happening at the border. So it's a super charged term at the moment. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I'm just kind of curious, you know, as you were working on this book, it's an 11-year project. It's this huge labor of love that you've been orchestrating for a long time. How does that feel for you right now as it comes out into the world with that term so charged?
I think it's really important to remember that the feeling is personal and it comes from a lot of different experiences. And it's important to acknowledge that freedom in each other, that ability to feel free, because, you know, it varies. We can enable that kind of freedom for each other too. And so especially that's what's happening now, where we, some people are privileged to have more freedom, just like they, you know, we have more space and more rights, you know, healthcare rights and accesses and things like that. But I think that freedom in particular, it just gets to the heart of something that's more fundamental than just joy or just the juxtaposition of levity. It really gets to the heart of what matters to a person, at least that's how I see it. And a lot of times with the answers, it's really revealing of something that's foundational in the psyche. Because joy, you know, we maybe have so many moments of joy, and it's so fleeting and so particular to the experience itself. It doesn't really touch on that same common territory like freedom does. Freedom really, it's still a heavy question. So I guess I don't really ask softball questions as one of my contributors kind of pointed out, but it really gets at the heart of what matters, I think.
I think that's exactly what the book does. And no, you don't ask softball questions. Even your questions where you're asking for a joke never really seem to end in softball material. And that's one of the beauties of the book. I mean, I feel like we have to take a moment and pause because I'm excited to talk about the particulars of the book. But just to give listeners a sense of what this book is and does, because there's really not another one out there like this. I mean, you're doing something, if it's not new, it's a rarity, especially in contemporary American letters. And it's beautiful. Could you just give us a kind of sense of, for somebody who doesn't know the book, what is it?
Well, it's called, the subtitle is A Conversation in the Round. And I was thinking about, you know, music and how music and artworks happen in this sort of three-dimensional space. And so this conversation never actually took place. That's kind of what the paper concert alludes to, that it's just a concert in book form. You know, you have to bring it to life, the reader, by, you know, hearing the language, hearing the voices in concert. But the actual conversations were one-on-one conversations that happened over about a dozen years, ultimately. And those conversations were in my head, in conversation with each other in this kind of concert. But they didn't exist in the world in that form. And it seems like a shame to me, because I'd gathered a lot of profound stories and insights that I wanted to share and that I wanted to collect and be able to offer to people, because to some extent, it seemed like a valuable resource, a kind of life's guide. You know, I called it a survival manual in the essay that originally was published in the Georgia Review that became the entire book later when I lengthened it. And it was a kind of survival guide for a kid who doesn't know how to act, but is constantly looking at the external world to seek, you know, affirmation and guidance. You know, I was just oriented that way, you know, growing up as a young girl in the South. And I kind of adopted all of these mannerisms and habits from my context. And so I thought that we needed to bring the voices together as I heard them, and to represent this concert in some sort of collected form. And it took a while to resolve the form itself, but I I did so by weaving in personal essays in the same way that the conversations were not one-sided interviews. They were always a back and forth dialogue. And so I wanted to recreate that dynamic in the book by including these excerpts, anecdotes, and stories from my own life that kind of give a sense for me as an individual so that I'm not just a disembodied questioner that's kind of posing these questions to the interviewees who then respond. I was also an integral part in bringing these conversations out because, you know, you build up trust and rapport and people wouldn't share some of these stories, which are deeply intimate and in some cases hurtful, without trusting me to, be safe in presenting them.
Yeah, there's a moment where you say, in my family, there were stories you would never hear if you asked for them straight, right? Mm-hmm. That you had to have this context of trust and kind of gentle prodding and create an environment in which the story could emerge. And one of the powerful things about the book is you feel as though, you know, here you are with these essays that introduce each conversation, kind of creating that context for us, the readers, to listen more deeply, to invest ourselves more deeply. And then suddenly the answers come to all of these different kinds of questions from authors, painters, musicians, it's really poets. And so we find ourselves sort of in those moments where, you know, when the conversation starts to become a little more whispery and things come out that really matter, and you feel like you're in some kind of intimate connection that's almost bordering on secrets are okay. Mm-hmm. It's a really wonderful atmosphere.
Thanks. It definitely felt intimate as I was having these conversations. And it felt intimate to reveal, you know, the personal essays too. Maybe it'll help if I read one.
Yeah, that would be great.
So this one comes, this is chapter 3, and it's called Sound Travels Through and Around Barriers. And all of the chapter titles come from something that one of the interviewees said. And that was actually a line of David Haskell's, but I'm just going to read my prefatory essay. Every spring throughout my girlhood, insects known colloquial as news bees emerged with the pollen and hovered nearby as if to tell you something. Wings buzzing like radios broadcast from another room. I tried to make out their messages as I strained to hear the muffled words of my parents talking in their bedroom after they kissed me goodnight. It was easy to imagine a hoverfly's presence companionable. They couldn't sting you any more than a ladybug who climbed gamely aboard an extended finger. Because my grandparents' farm was surrounded by Jefferson National Forest, I grew up in a landscape that dwarfed its inhabitants. We lived under skies whose bright planets I pictured in geometry class when we learned about parallel lines that never meet. When lightning bugs filled the trees on summer nights, they warmed the reaches of space, gilded the darkness, stars come down to close the distance between us and the next galaxy. The land was densely populated, just not by people. Deer roamed the woods and skies, along with foxes, eagles, possums, coyotes, snakes, field mice, mourning doves, and the ghosts of Cherokee and Tutelo tribes who had been killed or driven from their homes by settlers whose whitewashed version of history I inherited. Had the news bees I thought friendly in fact been reporting, they would have implicated me in past and present crimes. But the only communication they hoped to share was that the patch of goldenrods or violets I plucked was their territory. As a child, I felt I belonged to the natural world. I was of it among the mating calls of tree frogs, crickets, and katydids that thickened the screens we opened on summer nights. Congresses of geese honked into alignment just as my younger brother and I shouted from the backyard to find each other. Bulls bellowed their dominion behind plank wooden fences while we fought over toys until periodical cicadas scattered shot into rounds that silenced all of us. Thunder cracked over limestone bluffs that exposed geographical strata as textured as these sonic layers, which would have crashed into cacophony if not for the prolonged rest notes held by the mountains. Even as a child, I knew this score unfolded not in 4/4 time, but in 1 in 1.2 billion. I could hear only a minute fraction of the whole composition, but it encouraged me to keep listening.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Could you talk to me a little bit more about listening? If a reader picks up the book and it flips it, they'll see an introductory essay like you just read, and then they'll see something that might at first glance look like an interview until they realize that the person being interviewed keeps changing as it goes through, and the questions don't move in a linear manner, but in a more poetic and kind of associative manner. And so when you glance at the book, right, what you see is answering, but what becomes clear as you read it with your questions is that you are listening and have been listening not just to what the people are saying in your interviews, but to their work. There is not a single dumb question in the whole book. They are all smart and based on a familiarity with the author's work or the artist's work with whom you're talking, or with a deep-seated care and investment in the crafting of the question. And so there's this sense that you have listened very hard before the process even begins. And I just wonder if you could talk about listening as a skill or a talent, or maybe even a way of being, or a kind of identity forming.
Well, first, thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. I think the reason why I wanted to start with that section is because growing up in that environment, I was surrounded by different species and I didn't get the whole story, right? I mean, as much as I would have listened to the crickets and katydids, I mean, I was projecting onto them. I felt like I was part of that environment. It took a lot of, you know, biology class and different conversations with naturalists before I really realized what they were communicating. It wasn't quite as friendly as I might have imagined. And there weren't so many people, you know. I had my grandparents live just over the field until I was 7. And then, you know, it was a small town. You know, I grew up in rural Southwest Virginia. And so as I kept, my world kept getting bigger, you know, first going to grade school, then going away to college, and then going further to grad school, my world kept expanding. But the one thing that kind of grounded me, or that it remained constant throughout those years, was that by listening to others, I increasingly understood the context better. I understood myself better and the world around me. The book starts with the question, you know, who or what am I? And in trying to answer that question, I'm asking everyone like that, you know, like this little lost pup who doesn't quite know, you know, are you my mother? You know, who am I? What am I? And I was kind of looking for that mirror to reflect me back to myself. And so, and they did, you know, and they will. Your context will reflect you back to yourself because you are, you know, a product of that context. And so if you don't ask enough people to bring together a vision of yourself in the round or in full three-dimensionality, then you're going to retain a kind of flatness of character, it seems to me. That's my understanding of self is that, you know, you have to be in reflection of multiple perspectives in order to fully understand all the facets of yourself.
That's beautiful. I am something like the acquisition of all the voices that I'm willing to throw my voice toward and see what comes back. And if I cut myself off from different voices, I limit or delimit who I can be.
It seems so to me. And I consider myself very lucky to, one of the reasons why I dedicated this book to my students is because every semester they change and I get all these perspectives, you know, and they grow younger each year. And, you know, these different ideas and points of view and ways of looking at the world and life experiences and, you know, geographies and, you know, and I get to see myself, you know, reflected in their eyes and changed. You know, I'm always changed by these different perspectives that I encounter.
I think one of the, you know, if I was going to go for one of the quickest reasons why I would send someone to your book, and there are many, it would be that right now in our moment we're, you know, with everything that's been happening in the last year and a half, many of us are just starved for a sense of community, starved for being around those students, being around those groups of people that do reflect back dimensions of ourselves that are much harder to access in isolation. And then there's this sense of isolation and loneliness and separation that many of us are experiencing. Did you feel in putting together this book that there was something like a community accruing or generating? Because to be in it is to sort of be among fascinating people, you know, which is just like, oh, I just want to be out right now. I'm around some people that are lively, that are talking about important things, you know, that are fully human. And this book says, well, here, read me.
You know, one of my contributors, Kimiko Han, talks about it as a cultural intelligentsia. At one time, I was asking her why she includes science. So many of her poems are grounded in science. And I was talking about why she does that. And one of the reasons is to just put to establish a conversation between the various disciplines. So she's doing it in her poems, the kind of conversation that I'm implementing in the book. You know, we need to talk across disciplines and across demographics and across these various divisions, which I'm sure the pandemic has made us more aware of the need to, even as it's unfortunately made us more aware of the divisions, I'm hoping that it will shake out toward us realizing that the divisions are ultimately small in comparison with our commonality.
Well, so one of the interesting things that I found in the autobiographical and memoir sections of the book is that you really do focus on your childhood and your early adulthood in introducing yourself as the author of the book, as the one who's orchestrating the conversations. And I think it's worth saying that you are also a writer who works in a vast array of genres with a wide swath of interests. You're an environmental writer. You're a poet. You're a memoirist. You're an editor. You do art criticism. I mean, there's just this wide swath, but in the Amy Wright that we meet in the memoir sections, you wouldn't know that until you got to the author bio at the very end of the book. So I wonder if you could talk about the dynamic between kind of your, you know, mature adult artistic self and the younger self that you chose to foreground. We started with that was a place where you had a sense of the most freedom and kind of moved into that was also maybe the origins of listening. But I was curious about that absence. There's no, you know, it's hard for most authors to get their egos out of the way in the interviews that I read. And so they're often starting a question to another author with, in my work, I do blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And you are kind of so generous in, I'm interested in foregrounding the person I'm talking to, but you're also doing that as someone with, you know, a tremendous number of accomplishments as a writer and artist yourself. And so I'm curious about how that dynamic of your own art making went into your choices for what to include in the book and what to exclude and why.
That's a big question with a lot of different facets. In terms of, I do appreciate different genres, and, you know, I like to make visual art, and I also like to make music, and then, you know, and all of those things do complement ultimately my written work in various ways that I don't know that I always understand, but that is what interests me about other artists and how they're working. And I think it kind of comes down to that common ground, not to oversimplify any of my contributors, because I really appreciate the different perspectives, you know, represented throughout the book. But I also, within that difference, I think what interests me most is when you can find something core or human, you know, that you value. So maybe if I'm working across different mediums, I might think about, why am I doing this? Why am I making anything? Why does one make art? You know, that there's a kind of fundamental question to that process that across, you know, poetry and visual art and that you're striving to accomplish. And if you can understand it, then it makes, I guess, the transition a little smoother. So, and you don't always have to have the same, it's not like the same goal that we all have to agree on anything. It's just that there's something useful about searching across mediums, because, you know, you'll come up with different answers to the question of, say, how to live, or how to live in a racist society, or how to live in a sexist society, or, you know, how to live when you don't feel safe expressing your sexuality or something. And, you know, that question can be answered in art in different ways than it can be answered in music, in different ways than, there are a lot of scientists in here too, in different ways than it would be answered, you know, by a biologist who's, you know, working on listening to the songs of the forest or something. But it amazes me that, you know, if you do listen to the forests, or if you do listen to all these different instruments or vocalizations in the natural world, there are orchestras that, you know, people who go in and make recordings of rainforests and things like that can hear, you know, and there's timings and there's rest notes and, you know, and they kind of work out when to sing and into the silences between them. And then it creates a kind of symphony of sound. And I think of the concert and the book in this way, that, you know, it takes all of these different kinds of voices and we're not raising them all toward one simple ambition or goal or something, but in raising them together, it just seems that's beautiful. It's not like the tree frogs and the crickets have timed their song in order to make a beautiful, you know, song for the universe. They're trying to get their mating call in before, you know, it gets drowned out by, you know, the next species to start theirs. So, but it doesn't stop us from appreciating the fact that it does sound beautiful. And in the texture of that contrast, there's something fundamentally worth listening to.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
In that explanation that you gave, if we kind of take that as a metaphor for the book, in some ways, you provide the forest space for all of these different voices to come in and sing their song or do their call. Mm-hmm. And I was just curious, as you think back to all of the different people that you interviewed for the book, if there were one or two that you'd want to put in a car together to just see what would happen, if you could just say, okay, you two are on a road trip and I'm going to sit in the back and hear what happens. Does somebody jump to mind? Does a combination jump to mind? Which might be a way of asking, you know, you were alive to these different currents, these different energies of conversation, and you were seeing how they were working together and speaking through you. Having felt that, having listened to those, just imagining what other musics might emerge. Because one of the things I hope for from this book is that it doesn't become as singular as it is right now, but it becomes a model for other artists. I'm going to be teaching it to young artists in my graduate class coming up because I think it's doing such important work. And so I'm trying to imagine the conversations to come. And I was curious if any of those popped in your head.
The conversation that I'd like to, you know, put everybody in a car about, it would change based on the day. But right now I say that it would be Ira Sukrungurong and Philonie Slaughter, Dorothy Allison and David Huddle. I would put in this vehicle. And it's because on some level, they all touched on this notion of self. And again, it gets back to my original kind of question of like, who or what am I? And it touches on your observation that I was trying to present myself or trying to become a kind of space, a listening space where we could, you know, sound our differences. But all of those writers that I mentioned, and they are all writers except, no, they're three writers and one retired librarian, a Cherokee woman, where she talked about her native upbringing. But she came to a realization about selfhood that is truly profound in the book, just on the level of humility, and I think rooted firmly in her Native American heritage. And Ira came up, Sukrungurong came up with a similar concept of self through snorkeling. You know, this going underwater and being absorbed in that world and the change in sound, the change in energy when you get down there, and everything sort of shifts. You know, the way you might look at the world underwater is going to be very different from the, you know, your land view. And David talked about it in relation to photographing birds. And so he loses that sense of, you know, I am David Huddle taking, you know, calendar-like photos of birds. He wasn't interested in doing that. He was taking photos of birds, just doing their bird thing, you know, daily domestic bird life. And in trying to capture those moments that, you know, are so often missed of, you know, just feeding a seed to, you know, another bird or something like that, he forgot about himself. And so all of them in those moments recognize something really, I think, profound to the human experience. And if there's something that I would like to really push and keep talking about and have a more in-depth conversation about, I'd really like us to talk about, what do we mean, you know, by these concepts of self, if every one of you all has had an experience that was variously enlightening, you know, so when you weren't with yourself, when you had let go of that sense of personal identity. And to some extent, that's what the question about being free is also driving toward, that the very thing that we think will control our freedom is the thing that, if to go back to Michael Martone's starting question, is that if you let go of that desire to control, you know, anything, including your own freedom, then it's possible that something even greater will emerge from it, true freedom, where you're not having to, you know, be responsible for enacting that freedom or that self, you know, that sense of self, which is truly sometimes a great burden.
Yeah, I would think that would funnel in interesting ways into the notion of collaborative artistic process. I mean, you know, this is a book that could be described as a multi-author collaboration, and where the artistic self, you know, or sometimes described as, you know, a sensibility or a vision, what it would have to do in order to create collaborative work of power and merit. You know, I suppose there's some sort of version of that that could be you take two strong-willed artists and you let them clash about and perhaps something emerges out of that. But it seems like, you know, this idea of the self is most revelatory when it kind of disperses is perhaps a more helpful guide for how collaboration could work and how something could emerge when the ego boundaries soften and the will listens rather than demands.
Mm-hmm. there's something, it's different, you know, this, because remember, it's almost like one of those collaborations where someone just takes somebody's poems and turns them into song, or, you know, somebody's art, and then they, you know, they make words that correspond to ekphrastic poems in relation to art. And the original artist doesn't really have a say. It's a little closer to that. Fortunately, all of my contributors have been very agreeable in letting me reappropriate their original interviews in this new format. But there wasn't a lot of back and forth, you know, collaboration, because with, you know, over 50 contributors, it would have taken longer than a dozen years. But also, it's just, to some extent, you have to have a singular person, you know, integrating and assimilating a kind of conversation like this, just in terms of language and the way that, you know, communication works. We couldn't necessarily follow something that was going off in multiple directions without a single thread running through it. But I do think that there's a lesson in that, and it works for individual art too. I mean, we talk about this all the time in terms of getting out of your own way or something like that. I mean, it's kind of in that same vein where the creative process, however you think of it, does have elements that are that you have to receive or access, you know, be open to. There are mysterious elements of it. That's why, to some extent, we continue to create. It's because if we knew exactly what we were going to write, like, you know, some of my writers who do their composition essays, knowing exactly the argument they're going to make, I think you get bored. So, you know, we have to surprise ourselves. And sometimes that comes from another person who's surprising us. And sometimes it just comes from this, you know, this kind of unconscious urge that rises up in the process of creating.
So even if it's the case that there, you know, you were kind of, okay, I have these interviews and now I'm sorting them and putting them together in ways that are resonating for me as the orchestrator, it seems as though there are traces in some of the interviews that that the interviewees were wanting to push the conversation perhaps in directions that had maybe more to do with you than you were initially interested in, or to take it. There's some very robust exchanges with Mark Gaba and with Dorothy Allison. And there are moments where suddenly, even within the book, the interviewee and interviewer flip. And then it suddenly says, Amy Wright, and here is her answer. So I'm wondering if you could talk, you know, tell us a little bit about those moments. Maybe I'm off there, but it seemed like, you know, here the conversation is becoming perhaps more dynamic, or you know, the rules are changing in ways that might be surprising or fun.
Thank you for noticing those, because I was proud of those moments in the sense that the conversations went there. They also surprised me by kind of taking the reins. And it does require somebody to step up and co-create with you there at that moment. And that's a moment of friendship. In both of those situations, you know, Dorothy, thanks to a university assignment, I got to spend a great deal of time with her that I wouldn't normally have gotten. And Mark Gaba and I went to grad school together at the University of Denver. And so I was friends with both of them. And as we're talking about that, we could push each other as friends do and as friends should, you know, when we answer too easily or we dismiss something. And that was maybe my highest ambition when I first became an interviewer, to not just set somebody up to knock the ball out of the park or to shine on the page, but really to have conversations, you know, which I had gotten used to thanks to having good friends, you know, earlier in life, that people who had challenged me. And I wanted to keep that dynamic as part of the interview. But, you know, it doesn't always work. Sometimes you just need to, the work itself is challenging and you know, you just want to talk about that. But sometimes you have to kind of push. And it's a very, very, it's a fine line. And you have to have established the rapport and trust beforehand. Because as I talk about at one point in the book, I was working with the metaphor of a spider web from the very beginning, just this enormous spider web that strung its a string outside my window. And then later on, you know, the rain comes down and tears apart the spider web. And I had that experience in one of my interviews where I pushed the interviewee too fast, too hard, without meaning to, but just assuming that we had established the trust, and the assumption, it didn't go well. And so I write about that in a chapter of the book. And so it's not without its risks. And it's the same thing with friendships. I mean, I'm sure, over the years, you know, I've pushed friends in ways that, that changed our friendship. And, you know, and they've certainly changed me. But for me, you know, the kind of payoff is definitely worth it.
The interviewee that you mention in that passage, you say that one of the reasons you were devastated by this is that you saw the answers that were provided by this person as kind of the moral conscience mm-hmm. of the book. Mm-hmm. And I found myself wondering, do you feel now that the book is missing something of the moral conscience you wanted it to have, or did it shift to a new locus? You know, there's this sense of like, oh my gosh, I lost this crucial thing that I wanted, you know, like losing the violins or something like that. And I'm just curious as to what happened to the project as you went forward with it without mm-hmm. that.
Yeah, thank you for asking that too. It's, if you've ever lost someone in maybe in a relationship where they embodied qualities that you wanted to bring into yourself, I don't know, I at least was in relationships where I was like, I want to be like that rather than loving them for who they were. It was because I want to be more like that kind of person. I want to embody those sorts of qualities or attributes. And so when that interviewee pulled out, I was like, oh, but I knew from past experiences and various relationships, I was like, I have to go get those qualities in me. Now I have to learn how to bring them out of myself. And, you know, ultimately you can bring out, you know, those qualities. It just, it's going to take time and effort, and you have to go get different experiences and things like that. And it's not like you can embody who they are or anything like that. It's not that simple, but you can become more conscious of the qualities that they represented. And I went and got them. I went and got different interviewees so that I could talk to them about that experience. I went and talked to my friend Michelle, who's mentioned in the book, so that she could bring to light some more a part of the dynamic that, you know, that person was taking away with them. And so I had to go get it, essentially. I had to go get it in a different form, which, you know, for a minute there, I wasn't sure I could do. In the same way that when you lose somebody in your life, you're not sure that, you know, they and everything with them isn't gone forever. You know, it's heartbreaking. It was a really hard moment in the creation of the book.
Thank you for that answer. I think it's characteristic of a vulnerability that you show throughout the book that's really admirable. You know, I wept at the essay that you have about your brother. And there's a moment at the beginning where you're explaining the nature of your methodology for the book. And you know, you mentioned the spider's web as a kind of sustained image for talking about how this book is going to work. And you say something, you say that the methodology derives from fear, which is a tremendously generous act of honesty, just to be like, here's the deep emotional impulse that's driving it. And knowing that as a reader, you get to see this kind of like almost transmutation of fear into beauty as the work becomes manifest when you read it. But I wonder, you know, there are, you know, fear is not a thing that Americans want to look at. Certainly we're driven by it, but you know, even with working with younger artists or even, you know, contemporaries, fear as a source is still tricky. And I wonder if you could talk about how you work with those kinds of emotions, those hard emotions, as a writer, to say something like, you know, this book has a genesis in fear, and out of it comes this kind of act of artistic beauty, generosity, and power. I think that's something that certainly I would want to learn from, right? How do you take these things that are almost too hard to look at and use them as the basis on which to build something of significance and meaningfulness for others?
To some extent, that's why the spider metaphor works for me, because it's both. I mean, the spider builds a web or strings a web. And if you've seen the orb weavers, I mean, they have a 15-foot span where, you know, they'll string this anchor line across something. And I've since seen more of them, and it still amazes me. It seems miraculous. This tiny spider somehow makes this giant anchor thread. And so, of course, it's doing that out of fear, like fear that it's not going to eat and it's not going to make it through the day, you know, if it doesn't manage to weave this incredibly wide web. And so it's both very humble and also, you know, full of hubris. It's like, yes, or ambitious, you know, it's... And that's what inspired me about it. But the idea of fear, I think you have to learn to work with what you've got. And, you know, fear was what I had. I mean, I was taught and conditioned fear, just out of, you know, because my parents were taught and conditioned fear, and because their parents, who were raised during the Great Depression, you know, and were taught and conditioned fear. And so, you know, when that's what you've got, you know, you kind of work with it on a very practical level. It's, you know, it motivated me to sort of go out there and gather this information to kind of bring back and allay the fear. You know, the goal was to alleviate the fear. It wasn't like I was like, yes, you know, this fear is great. You know, I can work with this. It was like, oh, what can I do with it? I'm going to turn it into something else. And I find that's often my kind of mode, is to try to shift something that's uncomfortable into something that's more more agreeable, whether that's fear or anger or, you know, hatred or jealousy or, you know, any of the uncomfortable emotions. You're like, okay, what can I do with this feeling? I can sit here and stew about it, and that accomplishes nothing. Or I can, you know, make something out of it.
Yeah, thank you for that. I realize I'm mindful of the time and want to keep chatting about it, but I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't give you the chance to recite "There Once Was a Puffin." And if you don't want to recite "There Once Was a Puffin," maybe you could tell us about how that shows up in the book, because it's both charming, but it's kind of this poignant coming of age moment in an instant as well.
I probably have the whole poem, but it might take me a minute. I'd surely stumble, but I'll do a couple of lines of it. So there once was a puffin, just the shape of a muffin. He lived by the side of the sea. He ate little fishes that were quite delicious. He had them for supper and he had them for tea. And so it goes on from there until it gets to the end of the poem, when finally the puffin decides not to eat the fishes that were so delicious, but actually to invite them over for tea, which is of course unrealistic, but it's, you know, it was a poem in a children's book that I got. And so I had memorized this poem. It was a favorite of mine. And I just loved the sound of it. I mean, the rhyme puffin and muffin alone is just basically my aesthetic. You know, it's just the sound and then the weird quirkiness of that kind of rhyme. I mean, I continue to be charmed by that. And the birds themselves are just delightful and charming. But I had that whole poem memorized. And it was very long. I don't remember how many stanzas, but for a third grader, it was just like, how old I think I was. You know, it was a lot. And then I come to class prepared to recite it. And all of the other kids were memorizing these very grave and serious poems about battles. And I was like, are those the poems you all like? Like, I just couldn't believe that they liked those poems. And they didn't like them. They just, I'm sure now, you know, looking back on it, I'm sure that wasn't their favorite poems. That was just the shortest poems or the easiest to memorize or the ones closest to access, et cetera. And so, you know, I had this Emily Dickinson poem memorized, which I pulled out instead of embarrassing myself by having this childish poem, you know, in my head. And that was the kind of moment where I was like, oh, there are unspoken rules. And other people seem to know them, and I don't. And I've just nearly embarrassed myself. And thank God I read enough poems that, you know, I was able to lie and pull out this other poem. But, you know, I wanted to share that knowledge. Like, you know, we can't hold our knowledge secret. You have to tell me. Like, I can do it too, you know, as long as you you tell me what the game is.
Well, I hope that you will come back in the future and recite the whole poem again, just out of joy, for another conversation. Mm-hmm. Amy Wright, thank you so much for being on the New Books Network.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you for having me. It was a joy.
My name is Eric LeMay, and you've been listening to an interview with Amy Wright, author of Paper Concert, A Conversation in the Round, here on the New Books Network.